Put that little drawing in.
Oh, I closed it.
Huh?
I was embarrassed that I forgot to tie it to it, so I...
You did? Hey, we'll wait then.
I did it really quick.
Okay.
Found fault with it right off the bat. I already forgot the match.
I was like, oh, man.
The rest of the guy couldn't draw on
it. I just... yeah, that one's still okay. And then it's called a John Dewey 1 Day. Second to the bottom.
Bill, this one here. Just to show you that Charles Chung has been working on a drawing for us. As soon as he gets, he does that for the diacritics everywhere. So that's the scale. You know, the proportions are right for Jambu Deep. If anybody wants a tattoo, you have to go to America. He's not allowed to do tattoos of the Holy Dom on my decree. But you see the dimensions here, these are in thousands of yojanas. And you can see now that the dotted part is the base of Meru, and the solid line is the top. So you can see it comes very close to the boundary from the top. Of course the top is 84,000 yojanas. I mean, that's like from here to here, practically. High, too. This Meru, which include this underground part of it, is the same as the width of Jambudvipa. Anyway, so those are the Varshas. And so he's going to fix it up a little more, and we can all print it out and... put it on our walls. Okay. That's nice. He said each one as you go north to south decreases 10%. But it's not exactly 10%, so he went crazy before he realized it was okay.
Put it exactly 10%. Wait, I was flipping out and nobody's scared.
Was an approximate measure. Bharata really looks small, does it? Does it has a smaller Nutarku has a smaller area than the others. Okay.
How are you? Okay. You didn't put in the name of Meru either. We know what it is.
Yeah. I figured I'd do that on the zoomed in version.
The zoomed in version.
Okay, so I saw that the measurements were really
good. At lunch today, one of the guys, I don't know whether it was Chuck Janivas, Uncle Chucky, said in South India, he saw some replica there or some another local Meru, a Mandara mountain. It was an oval. They represented as an oval. Had the same thing it had the... you know, marks of the ropes on it and stuff like that. Like you said, there's one in Bihar. And there's some whole story about how Indra wanted it there and he didn't know how it got there. Okay, let me get to, something out here. We were looking at... I wanted to finish, stop where we left off, or maybe a little bit earlier, about we started talking about Meru, and then I decided to get into this particular issue about how it works. You have what appears to be a flat plane, Elise from Jamudi, by the way, you should know this, we'll refer to that one, that some of the Puranas actually state this, but it's obvious anyway, that the further in you go toward the center, the higher the elevation of the land, because water is flowing down. You know, so the heights of the land, say, above sea level, are greater. Because, yeah, it's obvious if Ketumala and so on, the river flows down to the sea, and Ilavitavaras is a very mountainous country, so the whole elevation is increased. Which makes me wonder about these measurements, whether they're from sea level or from the local average land elevation. But so it must be like, sort of like a, if you smooth it out, a kind of a cone with Sumeru in the middle. That's what it seems it has to be. But then as we see with Prabhupada, they're going to talk about a lotus, that the varshas are like lotus petals, which I get is a description, but I can't remember seeing it in the Bhagavatam, but it must be in other Puranas or other places, because there are old pictures showing varshas as shaped like lotus leaves. I mean, I don't know how you fit, that under this map, but anyway, that's...
I said that way. So we're going to go to... I'll go back a little bit, because we're just only doing this the last 15 minutes. First of all, I think we should... not everybody was here, but... June 15th, Prabhupada... People have heard this before, that Prabhupada had told someone that while flying in an airplane over Switzerland, he saw Mount Meru. And so I don't know exactly like this. They're showing him some sketches of that, and you can't tell from the context, but apparently Prabhupada says that I have seen, I told him, in Switzerland. Yes, from Switzerland now, and then Bhakti Prem is so big mountain. Yes, and he took, and then there's something, I don't know what that is, whatever it is, yes. The same with this Meru mountain, it spreads. And Prabhupada says, they cannot explain what is that. He's talking about Meru now. But I have seen it. Where it has gone, nobody knows. I think he means to say going up and down. Just see, down hundreds of miles and up. We cannot see more than 100, but in appearance, but it appears like the instruction. I assume that means as described. This is the one place in the record that I can find Prabhupada talking about this experience.
Anyway, so I just, yeah?
I was thinking about this, and we have to see it as a case of Krishna giving Srila Prabhupada some special ecstasies. Normally it's not visible to
the land. Well, yeah, not you and me anyway. I don't look out the airplanes. I flew over the Alps even. And
I do.
Yeah, so you didn't see it, right?
Of course, the Alps are quite expensive.
Yeah, either those people who have towers can see. So now, here they're showing all this context. You're talking about the moon planet, going back to that, how they didn't go to the moon. And then, tomorrow, Krishna, look at the Earth. This is a real question we have to answer. They picture the earth round, and we say no. Bhumanda is like a lotus. So he's using this lotus imagery for Bhumandala. That's clear. Like this, and the earth is only one part of one island in Bhumandala. It's not round, meaning a globe. It doesn't look like that.
And all the pictures they take of the Earth when they go up in their satellites show round. And we're going to tell them that it's not. This is a very tricky question. In other words, if this is the picture of the world like this, and we say that if we take an airplane from here, from Los Angeles, now supposing we go to India, which is here, I think we must have a globe or some kind of, which is here. So there's two ways to go. One way you can go like this, and the other way you can go like that. If you're in New York, you can fly east to India, or you can fly west. If you want to stop off in Los Angeles, Singapore, both ways, you end up in the same place. But if this Earth is not round globe, then how is it sometimes people go from Los Angeles via Hawaii to Japan and then to India? So we can't figure this out. We had experience that actually the plane went from Los Angeles to Hawaii to Tokyo to Hong Kong and to India. But it doesn't work out like that in our maps so far, right? We can't figure it out. This thing, that is to say this presentation, has to be very complete in its answers, otherwise everyone will laugh at us. We can't leave any loopholes. Problem. So you are thinking on this? And Bhakti Prem says, in Srimad Bhagavatam, according to Srimad Bhagavatam it is, and then you can't make out what he says. Prabhupada,
find out from our side, according to Bhagavatam. And then they change the subject again. That's on July 2nd. Right? Then we go to the next. This comes up again. Tomorrow, Krishna Maharaj keeps bringing it up. The next day. Now he says something's wrong with their instrument. Again, the moon, and then, the moon hoax, so something's wrong with their instrument. When they fly from Los Angeles and their compass, then Prabhupada says, nothing is wrong. Right? Nothing is wrong. From their estimate, you have to say, it is all right. But there is superior power. So as far as from what they can see and do, everything looks fine. They're flying the compass heading, they can go around the world. Nothing is wrong with that. We don't dispute that. But there is superior power. He just says that. Then Tamal Krishna, he goes back. They go due west and they hit India from Los Angeles, but according to our calculation, that's not possible. Prabhupada, you can go further, but you cannot go. And because of the emphasis there, you can go further. One can go further, but you cannot go. That is condition. You are restricted. The same. You are bound up. If an animal can go further, but he cannot because he's bound up. Ahankara vimuddhatma kartaham iti manyate. He is thinking, I am free. Made an idiot by false ego, he thinks, I am the doer, that I can do whatever I want. But he's free. He's thinking he's free. He's not free. So what is the value of his education? That is the real point. Come on, Krishna. They'll want to talk about another point. Not that you're stupid. Or you're not free. What's that? They'll want to talk about the point that the point on their compass that points west while they're flying in the airplane and it keeps going west. They eventually land in India from Los Angeles. Presumably the example, they take off from India and go all the way around the world. Prabhupada, you are flying west or east, you do not know. You are controlled. They say, no, our compass shows it, and you accept the compass. That's right, you are going west.
But do you think, where you think that the West is in, that is not in, you can go further? I keep going west, I keep coming back to where I started from, but somebody can keep going west and go somewhere else. Tamo Krishna. They say it never ends because we're going around the planet. We can just keep going. Prabhupada, no, that's his dog's mentality, going round. That is dog. He is thinking, this is the area, now I'm, you know, the dog. What do they call him? Top dog. He's controlled by superior power, that you cannot go. There's a leash on his neck, a fence. An example. There are so many. There are so many stars, moons, and we'll go there. But he cannot. Tamo Krishna says, they say, we accept this premise that we are limited. But then, limited, you cannot say final. In other words, if you're limited, how can you say this is what the case is? Tamo Krishna, but we say that within our limited means, we can understand that. Prabhupada, and limited means as, if you understand that I am bound up, I am going round the law, that is all right, but don't say that beyond this limit, there is nothing. I'm not so sure about this. I have to listen to these tapes too. Sometimes you pick up stuff when you listen to them. Once in a while, I guess. No, they don't. They don't say that, no. But supposing that within this limit, we accept that we are limited, then that's all right. But we say that we're going west, and that's right, west up to this point, rascal, not more than that. Why don't you understand this? West you have gone, that's all right, but up to this point, no more. You cannot go. You don't say there is no more after this western. They are saying that. Notice, because you keep going around, it means you hit a boundary past which you are not allowed to go. And there's something more there, and somehow or other, you can't see it. We'll talk about this in a minute. We'll finish this section. Saradanya. Yeah, they say then west becomes east. Tamo Krishna, right, they say. Saradanya, they say, Prabhupada, no. But why? Just because it's finished for them, Prabhupada, yes, because they're limited. And then Prabhupada says unlimited, meaning everything is unlimited. But how do they fly direct to India? I think unlimited way, Prabhupada's continuing. You know, sometimes he's not answering Tamo Krishna. He's just saying, unlimited, unlimited way. This question they're still going to put, this question that we say, here is Jambudvip, and here's Bhartvarsha on the bottom, and you cannot go beyond Bhartvarsha because you're conditioned, you're limited, that is our position. And within Bhartvarsha there's India, we accept that. Even we accept that. There are oceans, there are continents, seven continents described in the Bhagavatam. So their question is, okay, but how do you explain that you can go this direction, you come out in India, over back here, you're heading this way and suddenly you're this way.
Use the Pac-Man example.
Prabhupada, we don't say that this direction, what you are saying is the end. That is not. We say that it doesn't end, Prabhupada. That you can go further, but you cannot go. Therefore, you are thinking this is the end of the position, the same dog mentality. He's within that small area. He's thinking there's no more other space. That example is another, the bull. His eyes are closed. He crushes the oil mill going around and around. He thinks he's going 300 miles, but he's just They keep the eyes blind so he won't, Prabhupada, yes, understand what's going on, Prabhupada. Because in one place, simply going round, it makes one mad. So those eyes are closed. He's thinking, this is the end of the world. Come on, Krishna. So you have said that, but still, you have not given the solution. Prabhupada, this is solution. Come on, Krishna. You've explained it. Prabhupada, solution is that you are thinking, this is this. You are making solution. You are making solution. Come on, Krishna. We're trying to make. But I say, because you are limited, this is not this. What you are thinking, this is this, that is not. So what is? Prabhupada, Kupa Manduka, the frog in the well. He's thinking that this whole this is the whole water area. Come on, Krishna. Then what is it? If it's not what I am thinking, then what is it? Prabhupada, that I am explaining. Take it. This is so difficult. Come on, Krishna. But we can't explain it. That's the problem. No, no. Why can't I explain?
Prabhupada says, that's the problem.
It is there, given in the book. What are you doing? Come on, Krishna. According to the book, according to the Bhagavata and the picture that we have drawn, there's only one way to go from America to India. Come on, Krishna, there's only one way to go from America to India, not two, at least to our vision. So far, we have not been able to explain it. That's our problem.
Prabhupada. I do not want, well, I can bring our diagram, Prabhupada. Here is America, here is India. If you go immediately, then one way, that's all. Come on, Krishna. Yeah, only one way. But they go two ways, Prabhupada, two ways. So that, from New York or from San Francisco. Come on, Krishna. They can go from New York that direction, or they go from Los Angeles the other way. Either way, they come to India and they say, this, that proves the world is round because we can go like this or we can go this way. But we say, no, you can't go that way. But the compass shows, I am going due east. Prabhupada, so we don't say differently. You can't go this way. Come on, Krishna. But we don't say that because there's no round. We say simply it's a lotus. It's not Prabhupada. No, same example.
Just as an animal is bound up. So he's going this round and this round, the same thing. But you cannot go beyond it. That. Come on, Krishna. That, you know, we accept. I take the view of the scientists. Yes, yes, yes. We don't say. Suppose you are going round. You go this round or that round, but within the round.
Come on, Krishna. Okay.
But the whole question we're saying is that we say, no, you can only go one way. Prabhupada, no, I don't say. But according to our, he's going to say, diagram. Prabhupada, if you are going round, you can go around this way or that way. Come on, Krishna. But there is no round.
Prabhupada, yes, it is round. You are thinking round. You are going round. And then the tape ends. It's cut off. But it continues. That same day. So I don't know how much we missed. Obviously, they got shut off or they had to change it. But it goes on. Prabhupada, lotus is also round.
Lotus, that petal is also round. Lotus petal is round. So within one lotus petal, this round or that round, there is. Now this is interesting. You know, a lotus petal is not flat. The one that I showed you, it curves up. or maybe curves down. So already it's a different, it's not spherical, this geometry, it's not plane geometry either. Sadatanya. And within their own limited sphere, they can go this way or that way, but they don't know the whole shape. Tamal Krishna, we have to draw the shape, probably. Because according to what we've drawn so far, that you can do. But real thing is we can remain within the limit. Tamal Krishna, that we accept. Prabhupada. So within the limit. Suppose the lotus petal. Now you can't see people's hands or what they're saying, but this way, that way, this way. Come on, Krishna. So you're asking us to draw the details and make a planetarium very exact. Yes, lotus petal, it is round. So in one lotus petal, you are conditioned. You cannot go. Tamal Krishna, so far that hasn't been said, but that's, you can say that Bhargavarsha is a petal of the lotus, but I think if you look at the Bhagavatam, I'd have to see it, what it says. There's a statement that it may be the inner portion of the lotus, I don't know, and then there's a break in the tape. And what we do, it has to be with the Bhagavatam. Prabhupada, lotus petal, there are so many petals. You are conditioned with one petal. Tamal Krishna, that, if that's the explanation, then it can be somehow adjusted. You do not know what is going on outside. Then the devotee says, there are so many round parts of a lotus petal. Tamal Krishna, yes, that part, that could be adjusted. But there's a place within it, you know, the center part. There is no petal. In the middle of the lotus, there's like a, I don't know what you call it, but a, it's a flattish area. They show Krishna standing sometimes when they draw a picture of Krishna on the lotus. Actually, he has to be standing on the pericarp where we're showing Mount Meru. That's the flat area. Prabhupada, that's all right, but your place is in Tamal Krishna. That we accept. Prabhupada, that we have to hear from authority. We accept that. I'm just thinking, unless you are obstinate, you have to accept if you are convinced. We accept. Prabhupada, there are so many millions of stars and moons that we cannot go. Tamal Krishna, and as we are conditioned, as everyone is conditioned, our planetarium will have to show the actual fact. Yes. That fact we have learned from Bhagavatam. Tamal Krishna. So far we have not drawn this fact correctly. Because they're showing him these drawings of Jamudri, Prabhupada. That is your inability. That is another thing. Tamal Krishna. Yeah, well, that's why we're... That's the question that we've raised. The question that we've raised is due to that. That you are unable to do, but the fact is you are conditioned. You cannot go beyond that condition. Come on, Krishna. That is accepted. So we are also conditioned. But as far as possible, we take description from Bhagavata. Try to. That are, suppose here is India, here is Los Angeles. You start from India, Los Angeles, or India, you come to Los Angeles, and again, return to India. Similarly, you start from this, again going. Tamal Krishna, yes, that possible if you can fly this way underneath. And I assume it was underneath the lotus petal going around. Prabhupada, but where is the underneath? Tamal Krishna, see, Prabhupada, we weren't asking that issue. That's not the question we were asking. What is the issue? Well, you've explained, if it's a lotus petal, then you can fly around it, that's all right. Then the answer is there, but if there is no lotus petal and it's simply flat, then it's a problem. That's a problem. Prabhupada, no, we don't say flat. Tamal Krishna, we pictured it like that. There's some defect in our picture, if you recall. There's a picture we drew. Prabhupada, so rectify it. Tamal Krishna, yeah, well, how? Prabhupada. That is the explanation. Petal. Tamo Krishna. See, it doesn't say petal anywhere in the Bhagavatam. It doesn't say Bhardvarsha
is a lotus petal. Upendra. Neither does it say it's flat, though.
Tamo Krishna. Well, I can get the Bhagavatam right now if you allow me. It doesn't say. I believe it says Jambudvip is the second part of the lotus, and there aren't any petals in the center. Upendra. It's a transcendental lotus flower. Prabhupada. You are prejudiced. He's not talking to Upendra. You are prejudiced. That's, if I can understand, why don't you understand? You are prejudiced.
Tomorrow, Krishna.
Well, I can understand if I accept it as, I'm only trying to think as persons who are going to make this planetarium, Prabhupada. You are Western. You are prejudiced. That is reason. If I can understand, why you, Tamal Krishna? I can understand blindly, but I don't want to do that, Prabhupada. I do not understand blindly.
Tamal Krishna, no.
Prabhupada, then. But I don't want to. Still, we differ. That means one of us is prejudiced. Tamal Krishna, well, it's not your divine grace. I mean, I'm sorry you have to take this thankless task to ask you all these questions. Prabhupada, you are also prejudiced. It is written in the Shastra. In that sense, we are also prejudiced. Yeah, but we are correctly prejudiced. Prabhupada,
just like I take Krishna's word, Bas, fact, you can say that you are prejudiced, you see. This is the book. Tamal Krishna, that's a nice explanation, the petals.
But I don't think he means going underneath the petals. I don't think that's what he's talking about.
Okay, let's go to the next one. Because this continues on, I think later the same day. Let me see what I got for the bookmark here. Which one is we've done this for? Yeah, so here's another place. It's just a paragraph. No, let's see. Yeah. Okay. But according, so he's talking about another thing. He says, but according to the description of the Bhagavatam, everything that we've read, it is not petal. This is later on, a little bit. So let's, I don't know, on the one hand, you're asking us to follow the Prabhupada Bhagavatam, one portion may not be exactly like, just like if you are in the midst of the petal, you cannot understand it is petal. You see, it is flat. Just like, you know, the earth where the plane is round, it's flat, it's flat. You have shown in the map there is a point so many miles. So that petal, middle portion, you can take it flat. It is not flat. So definitely now he's talking about the surface of the petal, and that it's not flat. It is curved. Whatever conception you make, that is defective, rascal. First of all, you have to understand this. So don't make it like this, like this, like this, like this. Whatever it is said, that is all right. Therefore, Krishna said, Ashradhana, no faith, faithless. We are challenged by chemical combination, make us small eggs, barrels eggs, perverts, and then he goes on to that example.
The challenge the scientists, you know what, how it's done. You just make one egg. Please just make an egg that can make a chicken, you know.
So that here he says here, so we don't say it's not flat. It's curved.
So this may be, you know, in geometry, by Riemannian geometry, you set the curvature of space. You know about this? You know, you studied this? Sure. Well, I didn't study the geometry, but I read about philosophy of science. There was a mathematician named Lobachevsky. And Lobachevsky was just working with Euclidean geometry, the one we all learn, which is basically the geometry of a flat surface. And that has various postulates. Things that you really can't prove but seem to be pretty self-evident. And one of them is the parallel postulate, the fifth postulate, which the usual way to say that two parallel lines never meet. That if you have two lines and you put another line through them, the alternate interior angles are 180 degrees. Those two lines, no matter how far you carry them out, they'll always be the same distance from each other. So this one, it seemed to Lobachevsky, wasn't as sort of intuitively obvious as the other postulates, none of which I remember now. So he decided that what he would do is he would change it so that in effect they did meet somewhere. The two parallel lines would meet. And he thought he would just, with that postulate, he would just carry out the operations of the geometry from those postulates and axioms, deducing and doing the kind of work you do in geometry to get various other statements and so on. And he thought that somewhere he would find a self-contradiction, which would show that it's false. He could not find a self-contradiction. It seemed weird, it didn't make sense, but there was no contradiction, which is the ironclad law that you're wrong. So he published his results, you know, and it just sort of sat there for a while. And then, later on, when there was Riemann, started thinking that, you know, maybe we have various kind of curved spaces, a plane maybe, you know, of different shapes. And so with that, this geometry of that Lobachevsky discovered is figures that are on a plane, but is bent like a saddle, you know, it goes up and down like this. They were saddleback figures, and then the geometry made sense. So that space can be curved, and in that curvature space, what a straight line is maybe, or even in a spherical geometry, you know, the straight line is different from a Euclidean straight line, and so on. So that's so there are these different geometries for different spaces with curvature. I'm not a mathematician, but they use them all the time now, because in modern physics, space is curved. A gravitational field curves space, and so it's of use.
So now we got to the point that it's not flat. It's like a pedal, it's curved, right? But if you're in the middle of it, you think it's flat. So I think that was number four. I got one last. Okay, so somehow I didn't get my...
I erased all my red mark, my yellow marks and by accident.
What was
Lobachevsky? And the other was Riemann, R-E-I-M-A-N-N, Riemann. I don't know how to spell Lobachevsky.
Can you spell Riemann?
R-E-I, I think it's R-E-I-M-A-N-N. I think it's R-I-E, I don't know if it's German, it's R-I-E, Riemann. So here, this is Yashoda Nandana. The biggest problem we're discussing, we're thinking that the first question they will ask is their conception of the world. Prabhupada, we reject them. Yashoda, yes. Prabhupada, you are imperfect, so whatever you have written, that is nonsense. And everywhere a problem, why should we waste our time? Now, let's just try to settle from point of. He's showing this book. I am showing the Bhagavatam. So you are imperfect, that's a fact. What is the value of your book? If you are basically a rascal, then what is the value of your book? Why shall I waste my time? So first of all, I take it and I prove it that you are a rascal. You show your book, I show my book. But you have been proved that you are a rascal, because practically you cannot cross the Himalaya. You have no idea what is the Himalaya. You are giving some conflict. This, we have to reply to this question. If they say we start from Los Angeles and arrive.
So according to Srimad Bhagavatam, Prabhupada, Japan and Los Angeles and India, that is not the whole thing. Bhakti Prem, yeah, that is not the whole thing, but it is a basic point, probably insignificant. Bhakti Prem, according to Srimad Bhagavatam, if we start from London, Prabhupada, that argument I have also refuted. Just like animal is bound up, he is rotating around the log. And within that, there may be Japan, there may be Calcutta, there may be Los Angeles. You can think this is there, but that is not all. Within that rounding circle, whatever is there, you may think this is all, but that is not all. He's limited condition. So with this limitation, and there's some Bengali being spoken, I don't know if it's relevant or not. This is why we need to go to the tapes and listen to them anytime this. Within that limitation, he's speaking. But Himalaya and other things far beyond their limitation, that I have already explained. He's speaking within his limitation. Our position should be correctly represent what is described in the Srimad Bhagavatam. If there is some question, we should ask them. We should ask. Just like I am answering to the reasonable point that if you are conditioned, within your condition, you can see, you can experience, but beyond that, you have no right to see. Notice that word, you have no right to see. That's the Sanskrit word for right is adhikar. Qualification. What is Los Angeles, Calcutta, Japan? This is very insignificant space. And they're talking of that. We are talking of the Himalaya Mountain. We have crossed over Himalaya. We conquered the outer space. How can they think of it? He really doesn't believe, from his other conversation, that people have really crossed the Himalayas, because there's another Varsha. And so he takes these, so people go up and they go up in the mountains and everything, and they get so far, but then there's so many reports of accidents, people going out and not returning and so on. So he doesn't really think that they've crossed the Himalayas. You could say, well, we've flown over them, we've seen, but again, what is you have no right to see?
Bhakti Prem, how to take them to? There's no question of taking them. He said something else. If you take, he's all right. If you don't take, we cannot change. Bhakti Prem, as long as we cannot show them, first of all, you have to prove that you are imperfect. Bhakti Prem, that has already been proved. Prabhupada, yes. You're simply insisting on things by probably. Probably beyond the Himalayas there is something. That is one thing. We say definitely. Here is. Beyond the Himalayas like this. Like that. That is the difference. You say probably. I say definitely. Father, mother says, here is your father. You can say probably, but the mother is saying definitely. She knows perfectly. You may say probably he may be your father, but mother knows that definitely. Therefore, we're taking Vedas as mother, Puranas as sister, Sukadeva Goswami. Anyway, so they go on like this. These Mahajans, this is our argument. As far as common sense argument, Himalaya is very, very high, very, very broad. You have never crossed. And you have met with so many accidents. They avoid that portion, flying plane. the plains of I have seen how high it has gone. Then it will be in the clouds. Still they say 28,000, huh?
28,000, tomorrow Krishna 29,000. So I conclude like this when you show the book as authority. Oh yeah, so they come back to this. When we show this book, it means we're accepting the authority. Yashodananda.
Not accepting the authority. The problem is the specific ocean for Jambudvip. For us, it is the salt ocean. So the first question that Maharaj was raising, that they will ask, how do we go between the west coast of America, which is very tiny, and Japan, as this, according to their calculation, we go west and arrive around. And you keep going still further, and you arrive back in America. The point about the Himalayas, we did not raise that because that we could well understand. The Mayan is much broader and bigger than they think. We can fully understand it. But the point, from the common sense point of view, we could not exactly understand. We thought of it all afternoon, that we came up with a few ideas, but we wanted to hear what your divine grace.
Tomorrow Krishna interrupts him. Our question is mostly coming out how to draw what the Srimad Bhagavatam is saying. We're not supporting any kind of mundane argument, nor do we have any doubt of the Bhagavatam. We're simply trying to understand the Bhagavatam proper, and that is your credit.
Tomorrow Krishna, that's why we're meeting. Prabhupada, where's the difficulty? Well, I think that one of the difficulties arose from my seeing this map originally, because this map, it shows the continents that today we speak of as various continents. So when we all look at this map, our immediate question was, as I said the other day, how do we go from one place to the next? It's not such an unreasonable question, so we're just trying to answer it from the Bhagavatam, not to give our own speculation, because they're imperfect. Speculations, because they're imperfect. Prabhupada,
that is already answered. You are limited within certain area.
So you can conclude in so many ways. This must be some Bengali example. Sar, buri, kar. Kar, buri, sar. There is a vegetable prepared. The following vegetables are taken. Sar, buri, kar. You know, anybody know these vegetables in Bengali? Anyway. And again, you say kari, buri, sar. This way or that way. Sar, buri, kar. Kar, buri, sar. These, that three things, either you take this way consecutively or that way consecutively, but you have got only that kari buri sar. You have no experience. Then here's the, you understand. You know these three things, sar buri kar, kari buri sar. Just like they're making arrangements in the laboratory, companies are there, they presented it in such a way that he was flying in the sky, big Sputnik, very small town. Anyway, so then they go back to the outer space thing, and the moon, and so on. I lost my marker here, so I think that's the end of this discussion. So that's just to give you an example. In Prabhupada July, meeting with Tomal Krishna and people making drawings and everything of what the discussion was. So what do you think? Any ideas? Yeah?
I was just thinking when you mentioned this leash thing.
This what?
Leash, you know? Yeah. Now leash, or personal leash. And then when you mentioned the lotus petal, it seems to me it's a struggle. But it makes some sense because you go like this, and then leash goes back. So it's wrong.
You go, so here's a lotus petal, it's curved, right?
For example, if you have this Los Angeles, India, and whatever you have there, you go around, you start from here, and you go around, and you come back, and you come from other
places. Yeah, no, you're going around sort of like this, yeah.
But do you understand, it's different than the lotus petal. You have Los Angeles, India, and whatever you have here. Mm-hmm. So you start from India, going to Los Angeles, and you end here. And then you come back to India.
Mm-hmm.
So it makes complete sense.
Mm-hmm.
The petal is
I thought more like the hamster way. Yeah, because it's on ground the whole way, so you have to see it as a tube instead of a, because you're like going in midair. But it doesn't have to be a tube because it's all land. And you got the whole sunlight.
If the blood's fed off is curved. And if it's curved, you're not falling. And then you just go around in a lot. And you know, the leash is not a piece of rope or a piece of, you know, chain. It's some forces of nature. But how do all these two forces, centrifugal and centripetal?
Yeah.
How do you call them?
Centrifugal pushes you out, centripetal takes you back in, right? No, centrifugal goes in. Centrifugal goes out, centripetal. Yeah, centripetal force.
Centripetal.
That's when you have a spinning when you have a spinning wheel.
I was thinking that the pedal would actually have to be curved down, otherwise the rivers wouldn't go out to the oceans.
Yeah, I'm not even sure when you talk about the curvature that also it's a curvature of three-dimensional space.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It's a limitation.
Yeah.
Is that curve?
Yeah, the three-dimensional limitation is there. Bhaktisiddhanta remarks that we know about more than three dimensions for mathematics, and it's true. In mathematics, you can. Like if you make a graph, you have x, y, and z coordinates for three-dimensional space. You can keep adding coordinates mathematically. You can't see them, but you can add them, and you can. So people have topologists. I think a topography. They have worked out the mathematics of, you know, four-dimensional space, five-dimensional space, and so on. Now, for a while, they were just doing this for fun. And nobody thought it had any real application. But now it's starting to have applications in certain areas of physics, where you simply, to account for what you can see, you need to postulate more than three dimensions. And so Bhaktisiddhanta actually mentions this about higher force, more than three dimensions. And that's, to me, it seems that's what Prabhupada is talking, especially in the earlier one. He's using this example. So it may be it's hard to make a map. You know, you can represent a two-dimensional object that requires three-dimensional space to be represented. That's the Mobius strip. You know, you take a strip, you give it a half twist, and you glue it together again. Now, you're holding something that looks to us that has two sides, right? There's the surface, and the opposite side is another surface. But you take a pencil and draw a line on it, you never have to lift your pencil up, and you've got the line on both sides, right? You know what I'm talking about? You're doing something else.
Yeah.
Okay. That's a Mobius strip. So that's really a two-dimensional figure. It only has two sides. We're not counting the edge. But it only has one side. But the figure is actually existing like that in three-dimensional space. So similarly, they also have made there's a formula for a three-dimensional object which requires four-dimensional space to exist. It's called a Klein bottle. Klein must be the mathematician who came up with the formula for the surface. It's a single, unbroken surface, but it's a bottle with an inside and an outside. It's like the Mobius strip, there's a single one, but still, it seems to have two sides. And at the University of Pennsylvania Math Department, while I'm undergraduate, they had a Klein bottle, but of course, since we're in three-dimensional space, there was a certain defect with it. So it was a clear glass bottle. From the bottom, it came up, went around to a narrow neck, and the neck curved around kind of like a swan's neck.
And then in the model that they made, it went through the surface of the belly, the belly of this bottle, and went inside, where inside it was like a tube, and then it flared out and formed the base. You see? Now, the defect was it broke the surface of the bottle, because in three-dimensional space. In four-dimensional space, it does not break the surface. It goes inside without breaking the surface. That's a Klein bottle. So they had this, somebody stole it. It was a big problem because it was very, So, and similarly, you can keep on going, mathematically speaking. And they use it in physics more than, they require more than three dimensions to do things. And you can have space that's curved at the same time. And that's used in physics all the time now, the curvature of space. Because whenever there's gravity, it curves space. So these are different things that are there. I don't know if we're any closer. But I just want to show you the kind of issues that are involved. Prabhupada's absolutely clear this is the case. And he knows that these places are there. Of course, he has confidence in the book, but then he said he saw Sumeru himself. There it is. Yeah.
Is Prabhupada ever talk about there being other dimensions?
I don't know if he explicitly ever uses those terms. Bhaktisiddhanta, who's trained in mathematics, does. And it seemed to me from the first dialogue that Prabhupada was almost trying to talk about an experiment. And almost there has to be, if you consider the yoga cities, for example, that if with Prabhupada City I can reach now, and I can pick a flower from a garden in San Diego, California, and hand it to you, it meant that somehow or other this space and that space came together, or the intervening space was annihilated. They describe, this is the description I've heard, I don't, if anybody can know where it comes from, I'd like to know where it comes from, because maybe it's just a local tale. But it's said of the six Goswamis, that Braj Mandala is also described as a lotus flower, you notice? And Braj Mandala, it's described as 84 square miles, so it's actually quite big. When you go there, you suddenly realize when you're on a tempo or something and trying to go from one place to another, just how big this area is. And so it is said that the six Goswamis would be, you know, in one place meeting, and then meet someplace else, quite a distance away, and it would only take them a little while to get there, a few minutes to get there. And the story I heard is that, well, what happens is because Braj Mandala is like a lotus there on this petal, and the other thing is this petal, like a lotus folds up at night, they would just make it fold up and they'd step off and like this. That's the story. I guess we were all told this and everything.
From our three dimensions, we'd see them disappear from one place. And
They just seem to disappear. They go around the corner and vanish and show up somewhere else. But the Bhagavatam is full of stories like this. The yogis, they go in a river and come up, you know, thousands of miles. In fact, they travel to Ganga, the celestial Ganga, that way. They come down. Prabhupada mentioned, actually, in Kumbh Mela, that the yogis came through the Ganges from. You know, by this kind of travel, and their pathways in space. We were mentioning the Devayana,
But there are other pathways also. It's full of these pathways. I mean, when the Hi-Hi-Yas and the other people, they go through space, there are established highways in the ether that they travel on by their powers. Yeah.
Oh, I remember that Bhagavatam has got that four Kumaras went down to select the Ganges, and as well as the suit of Sankarshan, they said their hair was still wet.
Yeah, that's right. Uh-huh.
And another example, as you mentioned, this about Ari Vrashwana Parikraman. There was a story of one Baba, I don't remember, was it like Srinagi or something like that, and the best time was his hair was getting tangled into these spiky bushes, thorny bushes, and he would just fast, you know, in any way, Krishna. You know. But the idea was to bring Radha and Krishna together, to have their darshans. You know. And they said that this, two pictures, you know, he would do this, the whole life, like kind of whole Rashmanda Parikrama, that he would do in 1 month, he would do like 1 day or so.
Mm-hmm.
That was the whole idea about shadows.
Mm-hmm.
Opening and
closing. Well, there are many stories like that. I don't know if we can use it to prove anything to anybody, but it's definitely the case that if the yoga cities are there and people move around like that, and you start to think about how they do it, because that part is entirely, I mean, in the natural world. We're talking about Bhumandala. What happens there, we're really not talking about the spiritual world, we're talking about the material world. And so everything is really happening within the laws of material nature. It's just that we don't know those laws yet. We know a little bit. And what science tries to do, they try to figure things out by measuring. They've been measuring very precisely for a little while now. But from those measurements, they've tried to figure out the whole world by an inductive procedure. But they just can't do it. And if you talk to scientists about in their own field, what they're really working on, and they're honest, they'll tell you, we don't understand anything. Because there's always this point in science of like total confusion. Here this thing works, here this thing works. But if you look at all the puzzles that there are, that they're trying to solve and are working on, there are an immense number of things like that. They don't talk about it to outside of their own circles because they need funding and they want to appear confident and they know what they're doing. But inside, things are they know how rickety things were. And of course, I've seen how things change, and just in the course of time. When I first was becoming devotee, I was still going to graduate school, and I think after I met devotees and started chanting Hare Krishna, I had one more semester of coursework to take. And so I signed up for a course on the archaeology of India, because I realized right away that this version of history that I get from the Bhagavatam or from Prabhupada is so different from the standard history. And I didn't really have so much faith in the standard history, but there it was. So I thought I'd look at it and just see what we're dealing with. So I took a course in the archaeology of India. And from a teacher who knew exactly how much mud the Ganga brings down every year. So, the exact numbers the people are measuring. And so one of the things that we are taught, what we're taught at that time, is that the Aryans, the archaeology of India shows that there was the local people, the Dravidians, who probably the ancestors of the Dravidians who lived in India, and these cities they excavated like Harappa and Mohenjo-daro, and that at a certain time, coming from the north somewhere, these people called the Aryans, with their culture of sacrifice and everything else, and conquered, came in and conquered the Dravidians. And that, you know, Vedic Hinduism and that civilization arose subsequent to that. That's their theory. People have built a lot of things on it. In Mohenjo-daro, you find these little clay seals that have various depictions of it. And one is what they call the horned god of the seals. A guy sitting with his legs crossed, and with a kind of horns coming out of his head, and various animals around, naked. What they call Ipnagalic, I don't know how to say that in this company. Anyway, they called him Proto Shiva. Like, this is the early, like, Shiva was a Dravidian god, and the Aryans came with Indra, and then there was a conflict between these two, and then gradually they merged into a single system. And even I had read a book by a scholar who says that this whole thing is epitomized in Tatvam Asi. Like, he took this statement because Tat and Tvam, Tat is the Brahman of the Aryans. In their sacrifice, the power of the sacrifice was Brahman. Tvam, you, was from the Dravidian yoga, the self. And so Tatvam Asi really implied the fusion of these two cultures. That was just to show you, big things and speculations are based on this idea. So in the course of this, I wrote a paper on Harappa and Mohenjo-daro and looked at what they had, various things to say. This identified as proto-Shiva, and some things that people thought were Shivalingams, and so on. And I just concluded that the whole theory was based on a couple of little pieces of things and a great deal of speculation. It was like science fiction. You know, they took this little thing like this and made a story. It really increased my faith in Krishna consciousness, because I just saw that when you get down to whatever evidence this is based on, it's so little, you know. It's like this like big magnificent thing, and you open the box and there's a piece of string, a bird feather, and you know, the whole world is getting distorted, concocted out of these little bitty bits. So anyway, I become a devotee and so on, my area of study was not history of religions. I was into theology and the ideas of God and stuff like that, so I didn't pay a whole lot of attention of what was going on in Indology. And then about, I don't know, let's see, yeah, maybe about 15 years later, 12 years later, I'm attending a session of the American Academy of Religion, where all the scholars of religious studies have a year. And every so often I attend the one where the South Asian studies or the Hinduism, this was South Asian group, just to see what's going on. And there was this presentation, and a scholar got up, a lady, and she completely demolished, totally demolished, that the idea that this whatever they found in Harappa and Mohenjo-daro had anything to do with the Dravidian culture, that this was proto-Shiva. I won't get into the details, but she just destroyed the whole thing. And the idea that there was an Aryan invasion was. By then they were saying there wasn't an invasion, it was a gradual, peaceful migration over many hundred years. By then, that's what they were saying. But she was then saying that whoever was there, that these were not Dravidians. They found this horn was really a ceremonial headdress, and that is found in other sites now all over the, you know, what's now Iran and our, the Khamenei sites. It's everywhere. These little things that were supposed to be Shiva Lingams, these kind of smooth oval stones, were probably archaeological, because she showed us with very dramatic pictures that the older a Shiva Lingam gets, the more astronomically realistic they get. These things like these eggs that people worship, this is like it. Not with the old Lingam. Anyway, just, you know, it's a great light, a giant picture. So anyway, I'm just amazed. And everybody around me is going, yep, that's right. So then we're going to fast forward again to just a few years ago. And now we're in California, Berkeley, another meeting in the American Academy of Religion. There's a panel up there, a bunch of young scholars, some of whom were brought up in ISKCON by this time, by the way, but not all of them, and had various degrees of allegiance to ISKCON. And this panel discussion was on the evidence, or really the lack of evidence, for the Aryan coming from anywhere, invasion, migration, anything. And this was, these people had met at an earlier regional meeting, and they were having this big discussion on the internet, so everybody knew about this presentation. So it was a huge auditorium, and it was packed. And there was this panel, I don't know, eight people up there at the top, and they went through and dealt with the different kinds of evidence. Linguistic evidence, archaeological evidence, this evidence, that evidence, I don't remember the whole thing. A lot of it's not my field, I don't know what they're talking about. But they just did this demolition job on any evidence that the Aryans came from anywhere into India. Completely destroyed it. Now, I got to say, there was one guy in the audience, J.F. Stahl. You may be familiar with his name if you've read Signs of Self-Realization. Fritz Stahl, who's an Indologist. He did a big study of sacrifice. He's very famous for having been the Yajamana, the sponsor for a sacrifice. He got a whole bunch of Brahmins to perform a Vedic sacrifice so he could film it. Otherwise, they couldn't even afford it anymore. So before they all died out, because their sons weren't learning the mantras anymore, they were, you know, studying information technology. Anyway, this is J.F. Stahl, big authority on Vedic sacrifice. He was there, and he's retired by now. And so after this demolition job, he stood up during the question period, and everybody around me, same thing, that's right, boy, that's right on, this is true. You know, people around here making these remarks that they're all agreeing what these people are saying. In other words, everything you're told is a lie. It's still in the textbooks, the Aryan invasion. You know, that was already gone, you know, 15 years before. Now, you know. And they wouldn't even let Fritz Stahl talk. He says, I want 15 minutes and a blackboard and a chalk, and I'll show you that there's sacrificial evidence. There's sacrificial evidence. And then he mentioned something about some place name. And the guy next to me said to the guy next to him, he says, that's not a sacrifice pit, that's a kitchen. and they really, nobody wanted him to speak. I mean, they just were like, during the course of this presentation, it came up, if there is no evidence, why, for the last several hundred years, have people believed it, that there was? And the explanation was this, that when the European scholars in the 19th century really discovered India, it put them in some anxiety, which they did not like to even acknowledge their own anxiety, because they discovered Sanskrit and they discovered Panini. Without Panini, there be no science of linguistics, or it was called in those days philology. There was no, they were amazed that anybody had even analyzed sounds of language like this. It was like opening their eyes. And when they saw the Upanishads and other things like that, they realized that here was an extremely sophisticated, high-level culture, which was historically the mother culture of Greece and Rome. These are 19th century people, they're classicists, they worship Greeks and Rome. They, in those days, everybody had to learn Latin, almost everybody had to learn Greek if you were at all educated. And you had, you know, you had the Iliad, the Odyssey, you had Homer, and Virgil as the models of the great achievements of humanity, which was, that was the golden age, which we could never even come close to. And here was the parent culture of these people, and they had something that looked really, really good. And they thought, are these little brown guys running around here? They put them with the big duck diapers on. And so to relieve their anxiety, it naturally occurred to me, these had to be Europeans who came in. That was the explanation they gave for why everybody, when there was no evidence at all, believed and taught this thing as the absolute truth. I just tell you by way of telling you how things can change in the course of time. I don't know, maybe I have no idea. Even Prabhupada talks about the Aryan invasion as though it's true, because by his time it was just so well accepted. But I don't know if he really bent it, because in other places he talks about Kashyapa coming from the Caspian Sea region and so on like that. What is this region? Anyway, I just want to let you know how things can change. So whatever right now is dogma and the standard historical outlook. And then we see that the other thing had practically no foundation whatsoever. Want to turn that off?
Yes, and no.
It still doesn't help.
It does. If the UBS goes off, then it won't crack the ball to the fan zone. So after it stops working, you can turn the noise off.
After what?
After the ball's cooled down?
What else is it? I'm on this power too, or should I unplug my computer?
No, you're good.
Okay.
That's the other part.
When you're thinking of poison and forcing the conversation properly, you think you have no right to talk to us.
Yeah.
No right to see.
Yeah.
Also, the other guard to even understand.
Yeah, that's right. So
you have no right to see, no right to understand, you don't have the qualification. Those ever that Vishnu Ashokwara stuff, and he prayed every single syllable in the Bhagavatam to understand, it's revealed. So we just don't have the avatars to even understand it. It's all about a complete faith and conviction. This is what we're talking
about. Yeah, he does. Yeah.
We don't have the qualification, so unless we have that, how can we even present it to the world?
Well, he wanted us to, didn't he? So he liked, just like Vishnu Chakravarti, we could also pray.
Yeah.
That's why I figured a bigger part of this is learning how to really pray, so Krishna shows us.
So he prays every single syllable of
Bhagavad
Gita said on the subject matter.
Yeah, I mean...
I mean, it's not by our effort, but we're going to come up with it.
Like, yeah. Well, see, Prabhupada, in one sense, was not satisfied even with what he had done. Because he wanted to be able to make a model that people could see. And so far, he wasn't satisfied that he had been able to do that.
I mean, there's another conversation here. Probably we should look at that. I don't have any more.
I know yours is gone, but that'll only go every once in a while.
Prabhupada had a conversation with a Vedic astronomer about these things. He wanted to, the guy was supposed to be able to draw a model of the universe, and he couldn't do it. And so it's very interesting to see this conversation. But I have to find it here. I don't have it out. Maybe we can look at it another time. I have a bookmark. Anyway, you can't see it anywhere. Yeah. Anything else? So let's go back to Ilavritta Varshana, and when we can put this up on the screen, we'll do that. Do you have text with you? Those who have text, you can follow it. We went this way because we were talking about Meru, so I decided it was a good time to So we were going through this, right?
We finished chapter 16.
Yeah. So yeah, we just finished this, the descent of the Ganges. Our description of Jambudu. And the next chapter, having had this kind of overview, if you have this little thing here, where we go through Jambudvipa overview, Ilavritta overview, and the details of Ilavritta with the four adjacent mountains and the trees on them and the rivers and the filament mountains, Kesarachala. And then we talked about the top of Sumeru. So now the descent of the river Ganges, if you look at this little condensed version of here. So we follow the Ganges descending from a hole made by Vamana's toenail. And then it falls on Dhruva Loka. And then Dhruva takes it in his head. Then it goes down to the Saptarshis, who take the fallen water on the matted locks of their hair heads. And then it comes down the Devayana. The prophet says they carry the water to the moon, Indu Mandala, from which it falls onto Brahmapuri on Meru. So it goes right in the middle of Brahmapuri. It comes down from the moon. I don't know exactly how that looks, but anyway, then it splits into four branches. One goes off to the east. We always notice how we always start going east. The Sita, then south, the Alakananda, which when it hits Bhargavarsha becomes called the Ganges. By the way, it's interesting that this the word Ganges is never mentioned in the text, because it doesn't get the name Ganges until it hits Bhargavarsha. So it's just this. But you have to understand that here's a river going all the way through the universe, and a river not only carries water, but it's transport and so many other things that goes down. So the Chakshu west and Vajra north all go and they flow into the salt ocean. So then each way describes the course of each of the four rivers. And comes to Bhargavarsha. Then it mentions there are many other rivers too that are daughters of the mountains that flow through Meru and the other mountains all over the place.
And then we have three verses which describe what's called Boma Svarga. Boma from Bhumi, the terrestrial paradise. So Bhargavarsha is called Karma Kshetra, and the other eight are heavens on earth or terrestrial or earthly paradises. And it says where the residents of Swarga go at the end of their term to complete the tail end of their last of their Punya Karma. They come down. And then how people live and their pleasures there are described. And then he says that in the nine varshas, the Lord is manifested as a particular Vishnumurti deity. Prabhupada remarks that in the material world, the Lord is worshipped as his form, as a deity. Only in the spiritual world is he worshipped in his personal form. And then finally, we begin the description of the worship in the nine varshas, starting with Ilavritta Varsha, where Shiva and Durga Devi are together. So Shiva is described, and a little bit of description of him, and then he worships Sankarsana. Sankarsana, by mantra meditation and samadhi. And so each of these now, every varsha, the first prayer is in one place, it's called an Upanishad. It's in prose like in the Upanishads. Most of the Upanishads are in prose. So this prayer is in prose, the Om Namo Bhagavate Mahapurushaya. And then there are seven shlokas of metrical prayers. And then we go to the next chapter, which is called the prayers offered to the Lord by the residents of Jambudvip. And simply you go on through each of the varshas. Sometimes there's a description of some things going on there, but in each case there's a great devotee, there's some associated form of the Lord, and then there's the prayers. But the bulk of chapter 18 are these prayers. And you, as I showed you before in that diagram, you go from Ilavritta Varsha East to Bhadrashrava Varta. No, Bhadrashva Varta. I always say that wrong. And then south to Hari Varsha, the next one down there. Then up to Kitamala Varsha. And then you just, when you hit Ramyaka Varsha, and then you go north all the way to Uttarakuru. And then that's the end of that chapter. Then the next chapter, 19, which is called the description of the island of Jambudvip, we finish up the prayers with Kim Purusha Varsha and Bharat Varsha. Then from there we slide into a description of Bharat Varsha, where the deity that's worshipped is Narad Narayan Rishi by Narad Muni. So we get prayers of four slokas, an Upanishadic prayer, and then other prayers of four slokas. Then there's a description of the glories of Bharat Varsha, and we actually have eight slokas in metrical verse in which the devas chant the glories of, sing the glories of Bharat Varsha. So it's important. And then it mentions eight upadvipas, which I understand are offshore islands, of Jambudvip, and then a conclusion. Now that's as far as I've gotten this summary here. So that's what's going on, and And so now we'll just go through some of this in detail, because it's very interesting detail. Some of the prayers are really worth looking at. Well, they all are, but some of them are particularly nice. So we'll go through that. And we'll see how far that gets us. After this, then we start talking about some other things in this camp, in this manner. After that, then the next chapter describes distinctly what's on the ring islands. And that's similarly a similar thing. Each of the ring islands is one of the sons of Priyavarta. Priyavarta are in charge of it. Each of them has a name of a fire god. And each of these ring islands has usually a plant, but some feature from which it takes its name. And those are also subdivided by the sons of the into different varshas. And in the ring islands, usually it's a devata is being worshipped, but he's being worshipped as a form of Narayan. It's not exactly demigod worship. All the names of the demigods are names of Krishna. And you can. So that's described. And so we go in this chapter, all in
the next, which I don't have a little outline for you, but I can make one. All the way out to the to the edge of Bhumandala. And so from there, then we go up. Oh, now we're here. Okay, we got some power. What happened? I went too far down, didn't I? Here we go. Yeah, then studying the structure of the universe after the islands of Jambudvip. Which we said studying the structure of the universe is really about the ring islands and the oceans and so on. Then you go up, the movements of the sun, the orbits of the other planets, the Shishumara planetary system. So you're going up all the way up to Dhruvaloka. The Shishumara is a constellation just around Dhruvaloka. And then 24... Bilasvarga, there are the abodes of the demons. No, they're not hells because they're heavens. Although the word svarga, the etymological meaning of the word svarga is a big open space. And so this Bilasvarga means it's like going down in a hole in the ground with something that's a gigantic cave. I don't know. There's no light there because the sun is blocked. Bhumandala blocks any light from coming down. The light comes from the nagas. There's snake light. Jewel in their heads, right? It comes from the nagas. And each one is like a box. I think 10,000 yojanas square. The dimensions are given.
Those svarga ones.
Huh?
Those svarga ones. Caves like 10,000.
I don't know. Yeah, but they can go in and out of them. They can travel. They can go get out and somehow go up to svarga sometimes for battles. So they're described like caves, but I'm not so sure they're in the ground. I don't know how far down Bhumandala goes. I mean, Sataputra represents it as how thick it is, what it's made out of, but somehow or other. And obviously there's no...
They say there's no sense of time passing because there's no sun, moon, anything like that. Time, when time comes, it's the Sudarshana Chakra. It seems to represent a violent event. And then we have the glories of Lord Ananta. Ananta basically is the immediate expansion of Shankarshan, who's already being worshipped in the center of Jambudvip. And then he's directly, you know, at the bottom also, there's Ananta who's holding everything up together. And so Ananta Dev is described, and what's going on down there. And then below that is the hellish planets, which are just above the Garbhodak ocean. And that description of the hellish planets began then, because of that, in the sixth canto, Maharaj Parikshit, very distressed about hearing all these things, wants to know how people can be saved from going to hellish planets, and what can prevent them. Ordinary prayaschitta, we see people atone, but they do it again. Is there anything that can make people do something that will keep them from the possibility of going to hell? And then he describes the power of devotional service, and to illustrate that, tells the story of Ajamiya. That's what happens. That's how the beginning of the sixth canto is related to the fifth. All right, so that's a kind of overview of what happens here. All of this is taking place because they've just been going through the genealogy from Swayambhuva Manu all the way down, his descendants, and every so often there's Dhruva. So there's the restop, and we tell the story about Dhruva, and then we hit Rishabhadev. Oh, we got to stop and tell the story about Rishabhadev because that's a really great story. And this way, and then of course he happened to mention during the course of this discourse about how the son of Swayambhuva, Priyavrata, made a second son and dug out the ring island. So now that's what we're having this discussion here. All right. So I guess it's almost time to stop. So we'll start going through the next chapter. Is there anything else anybody would really like to talk about? Is really fabulously interested in? We can do that. I'm more confused by some of these chapters, but I can talk about them. But some I really would like to go through these prayers because they're really nice. And although it's not the science part, I think what will really make people attracted by this is a lot of these kinds of things that are depicted. And this is some far out stuff. We need to be educated in what's going on in the world that we can't, that we have no right to see. And we'll find out. And we'll try to get a power screen. It's going to happen every time.
That's quite possible.
Especially after
the year. Yeah, it hadn't happened before, the first time. Okay. Shiva Bhagavatam ki jai, Shri Prabhupada ki jai.